Welcome to the deep dive. Think about some of nature's most incredible designs for a second. You know, the strength of bones, or how insect wings are so lightweight but still robust, or even those fluid-carrying networks inside wood.
Yeah, they're amazing structures.
What if we could actually engineer materials with similar, really remarkable properties? Things like high strength, great energy absorption, or even pathways for fluid movement, maybe insulation.
That's the dream, absolutely. But it's a vision that's, well, traditionally hit a bit of a wall. Engineers have this powerful tool, topology optimization, TO for short.
Right.
But classically, it really focuses on single-scale designs. Often, it's just about maximizing stiffness, making something as rigid as possible.
And stiffness is important, no doubt, but so many modern applications, you know, aerospace, biomedical devices, they need much more than that.
Exactly. We need robust materials, multifunctional ones that can handle several jobs at once.
The problem, though, designing these super intricate, porous, multi-scale structures, the kind we see in nature, well, it can be incredibly difficult and computationally very expensive.
Oh, for sure. Just imagine trying to model every tiny little pore inside a bone.
Right.
The computational mesh you'd need would be prohibitively large. It's just a massive hurdle.
And that brings us right to today's topic. We're doing a deep dive into Verodo. It's a novel method that's tackling this exact challenge.
Mm-hmm.
It's a multi-scale topology optimization framework. It uses Voronoi structures, which actually look strikingly like natural porous materials.
They really do.
And here's the really interesting part. It leverages the power of neural networks to make this whole complex design process way more efficient.
So our mission today is really to unpack how this Verodo method works, why it's such a big step forward for designing advanced materials, and maybe what surprising insights it gives us for building materials inspired by nature.
Yeah, you're about to get a real shortcut to understanding the cutting edge of material design. Okay, so let's kick things off with the basics. For anyone maybe newer to this, can you give us a quick rundown? What is topology optimization?
Yeah, simply put, it's an engineering tool. It figures out the best place to put material within the set design area.
Okay.
The goal is to get the best performance, you know, under certain limits or constraints.
Mm-hmm.
And traditional TO, it mostly deals with single scale designs, often just trying to make something as stiff as possible for a specific load.
But like we said, the real world often needs more than just stiffness. You mentioned multifunctional materials. What are some of these other critical properties engineers are looking for?
Well, beyond just stiffness, we're often looking for things like structural robustness, high strength to weight ratios,
mm-hmm.
really good energy absorption, maybe efficient fluid circulation paths, even thermal or acoustic insulation.
Wow. Okay.
These are super important for industries like aerospace, automotive, biomedicine, places where materials absolutely have to perform multiple jobs at the same time.
And this is really where looking at nature gives us such a great blueprint, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. So many natural structures just inherently have these multifunctional properties. Think about bones again, specifically the calcaneus, the heel bone,
right,
or the internal structure of wood, or even those tiny, intricate veins in insect wings. They're not just strong. They achieve all these different functions through really organized, but often quite irregular internal structures.
Let's unpack that a bit. How exactly do they manage that?
It's through these intricate arrangements of porous structures. And these structures often show stochasticity. That means a kind of controlled randomness.
Okay.
They also show anisotropy, where properties change depending on the direction you measure them. And they have remarkable internal connectivity. It's not just solid material. It's the smart distribution of voids and channels.
The heel bone example is great. When we walk, it takes complex loads, right? And it can be modeled sort of simply as a cantilever beam.
Exactly. And what's really fascinating is that bone growth itself is like a continuous self-optimization process. It's always adapting its internal structure based on the loads it experiences.
So if you took that heel bone and just used traditional single-scale TO, aiming only for maximum stiffness,
you'd get a design that's optimal for stiffness, sure.
Yeah.
Probably quite solid, dense. But crucially, it would completely lack that essential porosity needed for fluid movement.
Like blood flow, nutrients.
Precisely. Blood, interstitial fluid, things vital for oxygen and nutrient exchange in living bone. The traditional TO design misses that entirely.
So if you then tried to design a porous structure, maybe sacrificing some stiffness to get that porosity,
you immediately see the trade-off. It highlights this conflict engineers often face.
Yeah.
Stiffness versus other functions like porosity.
And that's the core issue, right? Trying to actually compute these complex, porous, multi-scale structures systematically is a huge computational challenge.
It really is. I mean, theoretically, you could try using super high-resolution single-scale TEO, but in practice, it's just not viable. The computational meshes required to capture all those thin, intricate features would be astronomically large. We desperately need a new approach.
And that new approach brings us to Voronoi structures, which are absolutely central to this Voroto method. Can you explain what a Voronoi diagram is?
Sure. Imagine you have a bunch of points, or sites, scattered in the space. A Voronoi diagram divides that space into regions, or cells.
Okay.
Each cell contains all the points in the space that are closer to its specific site than to any other site. It's like drawing property lines based on nearest neighbors.
Okay. And why are these diagrams so relevant for designing materials?
Well, these Voronoi tessellations, the patterns they create, turn out to be excellent models for the kind of complex, irregular, sometimes random shapes you find in natural porous materials. Like trabecular bone, the spongy bone inside our skeletons. They offer a lot of design freedom, and they can naturally represent properties that vary with direction that anisotropy we mentioned. They've been used before for various things like skiff structures or functionally graded materials, where properties change gradually across the structure.
So Voronoi structures aren't entirely new to this field. What were the limitations of the older methods that tried to use them for optimization?
Right, they've been explored. But past methods, particularly stochastic ones, those based on randomness, often led to what the paper calls extensive data occupancy, meaning they needed a lot of data storage and they were very computationally intensive, just slow.
Okay.
Other methods either couldn't handle anisotropic designs where properties vary with direction, or they lacked the ability to use continuous sensitivity analysis for optimization, which is really key for efficiency.
Hmm.
And some methods only produced designs where the thickness was constant everywhere, which really limits how much you can customize the structure and its function.
And this is precisely where Vorto comes in with a significant innovation. They've developed this novel framework specifically to create optimized multi-scale Voronoi designs.
Yeah, and the key difference is that these designs can have spatially varying thickness and anisotropy. That ability to vary these properties locally is a huge leap forward for mimicking nature's complexity.
So what's the core idea behind this innovation?
The heart of it is a multi-scale design approach combined with an offline trained neural network. This network is trained beforehand.
Okay.
Its job is to learn the mapping between the parameters that define a Voronoi microstructure, like site locations, thickness, anisotropy, and its resulting homogenized properties. Those are the effective bulk properties you'd measure.
And beyond just using the neural network, they've made some other key contributions too, right? Like expanding the design space.
Yes, definitely. Allowing for these anisotropic Voronoi cells with varying thickness significantly enhances the potential performance compared to simpler models.
And connectivity. That seems important for porous structures.
Crucial. They explicitly consider neighboring cell sites during the design process. This helps promote connectivity across the larger macroscale structure, which was a limitation in some earlier multi-scale methods.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a bit technical, but very important, they ensure the stiffness matrix predicted by the neural network is always positive definite, meaning it represents a physically realistic, stable material. You can't have a material that, you know, gets softer when you push on it in a certain way. This guarantees the designs make physical sense.
Got it. And you mentioned earlier, for the engineers listening, that the framework is end-to-end differentiable. Why is that such a big deal?
It's a huge deal for efficiency. Mm-hmm. It enables automated sensitivity analysis using gradient-based optimization methods.
Okay.
Basically, the software can automatically figure out exactly how changing each design parameter affects the overall performance. This avoids tons of manual calculation and makes the optimization process much, much faster and more precise.
Okay, so let's get into the nuts and bolts. How does this Voro method actually work? You said it's a two-stage strategy.
That's right. It cleverly breaks the problem down. Stage one is what they call offline computation. Think of this as the prep work.
Right.
This is where they generate a whole bunch of representative Voronoi microstructures. They calculate the properties for each one using detailed simulations, and then they use all that data to train the neural network.
So stage one is all about teaching the network, then stage two.
Stage two is the multi-scale optimization. This is where the trained neural network really shines. It acts as a super fast surrogate model or a stand-in to help generate the final optimized Voronoi structure for the actual design problem.
Okay, let's dive deeper into stage one then, the offline part. How does this neural network actually learn, starting with generating those microstructures?
Right, you need a large data set, but just generating isolated microstructures isn't enough. You might get weird artificial boundaries between elements. So their solution is quite smart. To get realistic representation, especially at the boundaries, they consider a central macro element and its 8 immediate neighbors.
9 elements in total.
Exactly.
Yeah.
They generate random cell sites within all 9 elements, but then they only actually generate and analyze the microstructure for the central one. This process ensures that the topology and connectivity at the edges of the central element are realistic, like they would be in a larger structure.
Clever. And what parameters are they varying when they generate these?
They vary things like the thickness of the Voronoi cell walls, the degree of anisotropy, how much properties vary with direction, and the orientation of that anisotropy. These are sampled uniformly across predefined ranges. For example, thickness might go from 0.3 to 3, anisotropy from 1 to 3.5, orientation from 0 to pi radians.
Got it. So once they have these diverse microstructures, what's next?
Then, for each generated microstructure within its macro element, they discretize it into a very fine grid. The paper mentions 120 by 120 microelements, so that's quite detailed. This detailed mesh is then used for a process called numerical homogenization. This essentially calculates the effective, averaged-out elasticity matrix called C for that microstructure, as well as its volume fraction. They assume some standard material properties like Young's modulus E01 and Poisson's ratio V0.3 just to simplify these calculations.
Now, you mentioned something earlier, a crucial step involving Kolesky decomposition. Why do they do that?
This is really important for ensuring the neural network produces physically valid results. See, if you just train the network to directly predict the, say, 6 independent components of the stiffness matrix, C, it might output a combination of values that doesn't correspond to a real stable material. Mathematically, the matrix might not be positive definite.
Which would be a problem.
A big problem. So to prevent this, they first perform a Kolesky decomposition on the calculated stiffness matrix, C. This decomposes C into the product of a lower triangular matrix, L, and its transpose, L times L transpose.
Okay, a mathematical trick.
Exactly. And the key is, they train the neural network to predict the components of this L matrix, not the C matrix directly. Since L times L transpose is always positive definite, or semi-definite, this cleverly guarantees that any stiffness matrix reconstructed from the network's predicted L will always be physically valid.
That's neat. So then the neural network training itself, what goes into the network?
The input is quite comprehensive. It takes the X and Y coordinates of the cell sites from all 9 macro elements, the central one and its 8 neighbors.
Okay, so context matters.
It does. And it also takes a 3 geometric parameters, thickness, anisotropy, and orientation, but only for the central element whose properties are being predicted. This makes for a pretty high-dimensional input vector.
And the network itself, is it complex?
Actually, the architecture they used is relatively standard for this kind of task. It's a fully connected network, sometimes called a multi-layer perceptron. It has 4 hidden layers, each with 50 neurons. They use common techniques like ReLU activation functions and batch normalization. It seems this setup was sufficient to learn the complex mapping accurately.
And what does the network output?
It outputs 2 things. The 6 independent components of the predicted L matrix, let's call it L hat, and the predicted volume fraction, V hat. And there's one final check. To absolutely ensure physical validity, the diagonal components of the predicted L-hat matrix are clipped, basically. If they predict a value below a tiny positive threshold, they just set it to that threshold.
Okay. Keeps things stable. And how is it trained? What's the goal?
It's trained on a data set of 10,000 of these microstructure examples. The training process aims to minimize the mean squared difference between the network's predictions, L-hat and V-hat, and the actual properties calculated during the homogenization step.
So it learns to be accurate.
Exactly. This whole offline process creates this highly accurate, but crucially computationally cheap, surrogate model. Instead of running those expensive homogenization simulations over and over during the main optimization, the design process can just ask the trained network for the properties and get an answer almost instantly. That's the big payoff.
All right, so that's the intensive offline preparation. Now let's move to stage 2, the multi-scale optimization in action. This is where that pre-trained network gets put to work.
Precisely. Now we're looking at the actual design problem.
Right.
Each macro element, in the design domain has its own set of design variables, the locations of its Voronoi cell sites, its specific thickness, anisotropy value, and orientation.
And the magic is using that surrogate NN.
Absolutely. At every step of the optimization algorithm, instead of doing a full, slow homogenization calculation for each element to find its stiffness, you just feed the element's current design variables, site locations, thickness, etc., into the trained neural network. And boom, it instantly predicts the L-hat matrix, and therefore the effective stiffness C-hat, and the volume fraction V-hat. It's incredibly fast.
That makes sense. And you mentioned earlier it also promotes macroscale connectivity. How does that part work in this stage?
Right. Connectivity is important. They apply a smoothing radial filter. This filter averages the thickness, anisotropy, and orientation parameters for a given element based on the values of its neighboring elements.
Okay, like blurring them slightly.
Sort of, yeah. It helps to smooth out any sudden, abrupt changes in microstructure properties between adjacent elements. This encourages more continuous connected pathways for stress or fluids throughout the overall macrostructure.
So what's the main goal the optimization is trying to achieve?
Typically, the primary objective is compliance minimization. That's engineer speak for making the structure as stiff as possible or minimizing its overall deformation under the given loads. Mm. And this is usually subject to a constraint, most commonly a global volume constraint, ensuring the total amount of material used doesn't exceed a certain budget, maybe like 40% or 60% of the total design space. The optimization itself is formulated as minimizing a loss function, often using a penalty method, which adds a cost if the volume constraint is violated. It's a pretty standard optimization setup.
And you mentioned sensitivity analysis being automated. How does that fit in here?
It's critical for making the optimization efficient. The optimizer needs to know how changing each design variable affects the objective compliance and the constraint volume.
Right, the derivatives.
Exactly. And because the whole process, including the neural network prediction, is built using tools like PyTorch, which support automatic differentiation, AD or TD, they just need to define the forward calculations, how to get from variables to compliance and volume. The software then automatically computes all the necessary derivatives, the sensitivities, with high precision. It saves an enormous amount of work compared to trying to derive or approximate these derivatives manually.
Okay, theory sounds great, but does it actually deliver? Let's look at the numerical experiments. What did they test?
They ran several tests. The default setup used a MacBook M2 Air, interestingly, showing it doesn't need supercomputer power for the optimization stage. The typical domain was discretized into 40 by 20 macro elements.
In the first test case.
A standard validation problem, a tensile bar. The goal was to minimize compliance, make it stiff under tension, with a target volume fraction of 40%.
And the results?
What's really cool here is that the Vorta method produced a multi-scale porous design. And visually, this porous structure actually resembles the shape of an ideal solid tensile bar, but with porosity built in.
Huh.
Near the transition zones, the porous structures were oriented along the tensile axis, which is exactly what you'd expect for optimal load transfer. It achieved a compliance value of 209. For comparison, a traditional single-scale optimization resulting in a solid bar got 183.
So slightly less stiff, but now porous.
Exactly. That difference reflects the necessary trade-off for incorporating that porosity constraint.
Okay, what other problems did they tackle?
They also looked at a mid-cantilever beam problem, basically. A beam fixed at one end with a load applied in the middle of the top edge. Again, minimizing compliance, this time with a 60% volume fraction.
And how did Vorta perform?
It achieved a compliance of 68.3. This compares really well. A single-scale solid design achieved 61.05. Stiffer, but solid. Another method that creates porous designs using local volume limits got 76.86, noticeably less stiff than Vorta.
So Vorta did better than that other porous method.
Yes, and a key advantage highlighted is that the Vorta method achieves these efficient porous structures without needing to impose local volume constraints on each element. Those local constraints, used in some other methods, can sometimes overly restrict the design freedom.
And how fast was this optimization?
Get this, that mid-cantilever optimization took only 13.7 seconds on the MacBook Air.
Wow, okay, that's fast. But how accurate are the predictions from the neural network during that optimization?
Good question. They checked that. After the optimization finished, they took the final optimized design parameters, actually reconstructed the detailed microstructures for each element, and reran the high-fidelity homogenization simulations to get the true properties. The error between the neural network's predicted performance during optimization and the final verified performance was remarkably low. For that cantilever example, the error in compliance was about 8.4%. and the error in volume fraction was just 6.1%. So the NN surrogate is doing a really good job.
That's impressive accuracy for the speed gain. Did they look at how varying the design parameters, like thickness range, affects the outcome?
They did. They found that the objective function compliance consistently improved, meaning it decreased, which is better, as they allowed a wider range for the thickness parameter, say from 0.3 up to 3.
So more freedom in thickness helps.
Definitely. It shows the clear benefit of being able to design with spatially varying thickness, letting the optimizer put thicker or thinner struts where needed.
What about anisotropy and orientation?
Same story. Allowing a wider range for the degree of anisotropy from 1 up to 3.5 also led to lower compliance, better performance. And if they fixed the orientation parameter, preventing it from changing, the performance was worse.
So allowing variable orientation is also crucial.
Absolutely. These experiments strongly validate one of the core ideas. Giving the optimizer a broader range of design parameters to play with thickness, anisotropy, and orientation leads to significantly better multi-scale designs.
Okay, this brings us back to a really important practical question. Is all that upfront effort in stage one, the offline computation, generating data, training the NN, is it actually worth it?
It's a fair question, but the results suggest a resounding yes.
Okay, lay out the numbers.
The offline overhead generating 12,000 microstructures for training and validation, plus actually training the neural network, took a total of about 28.4 minutes on their machine.
Yep.
Roughly 26 minutes for data generation, 2 minutes for training.
Right, but that's a one-time cost. You do it once.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. It's a one-time investment. After that's done, running an actual optimization, like that mid-cantilever problem we discussed, it took only 0.24 minutes, less than 15 seconds.
Okay, now compare that.
The comparison is staggering. If you try to do this using a brute force, high resolution, single scale optimization without any multi-scale approach or NN, they estimate a single iteration could take around 16.6 minutes.
Whoa.
Assuming maybe 300 iterations for convergence, that blows up to an estimated 4,986 minutes. That's over 80 hours of computation.
Okay, that's clearly not feasible for routine design. What about other multi-scale methods?
Even if you used a multi-scale approach, but performed the homogenization calculation on the fly for each element at each step without a pre-trained NN surrogate, they estimate it would take around 528 minutes, almost 9 hours.
So 15 seconds versus 9 hours or 80 hours.
It's not even close. The proposed offline NN-based multi-scale optimization is computationally vastly superior. And as we saw, with only a minimal loss in final accuracy. This computational efficiency is the real power of Verodo. It's an incredible shortcut to designing these highly complex, nature-inspired structures efficiently.
Okay, let's recap then. We've taken a really deep dive into Verodo, this novel multi-scale topology optimization framework.
We saw how it cleverly uses Voronoi microstructures, which resemble natural materials, and combines them with a pre-trained neural network. This network creates a fast, continuous, and differentiable map from the microstructure's design parameters to its effective material properties.
And the big takeaway seems to be the huge computational advantage this offers over traditional methods while maintaining remarkable accuracy.
Yeah, and it really expands the design possibilities by allowing structures with spatially varying thickness, anisotropy, and orientation. Plus, it effectively promotes macroscale connectivity and guarantees physically valid designs by training on those Kolesky factors.
So what does this all mean, big picture?
Well, I think it means we're really starting to unlock the ability to design incredibly complex functional materials, materials directly inspired by the clever solutions found in nature, but designed in a way that's actually computationally feasible for real-world engineering tasks.
It feels like the journey of biomimicry in engineering is really accelerating. It makes you wonder what's next. We've talked mostly about structural integrity, stiffness.
Right.
But what about those other natural designs? Like you mentioned, the multifunctional pores in bone, they provide support and transport fluids. Could we start designing for that?
That's a fantastic direction.
Mm.
How could we integrate objectives like fluid flow efficiency or heat transfer into these optimization formulations alongside stiffness, making truly multi-objective designs?
Or even taking it further. Could we design materials that adapt and remodel themselves over time, like bone does, according to Wolff's law, responding dynamically to stress?
Imagine that. And what about extending this framework to full 3D designs, or maybe handling non-rectangular shapes more easily? Creating materials that aren't just strong, but genuinely intelligent and adaptable. What stands out to IU is the potential next big breakthrough in this space.